Well, thank you, choir. That was beautiful. That's a lot. Certainly interesting looking at the demographic makeup of the choir. Some men in there that I went to college with, at least one or two, that are obviously geriatric and advanced in years now. And we have little children who are just enthusiastically adding their cheerful voice. And a director that I prayed would exist. Just amazing. Just amazing. Because it's always wonderful to go back to where you came from or where you started, so to speak. Don't have that many days in my memory that I can remember the details of that day. Mr. Reeves talked about the tornado. I remember a day back in 1982 when I had resigned my job as an engineer and I was cleaning out my desk at work, and the men I worked with were coming by and saying their goodbyes and rolling their eyes saying, "Why are you doing this?" And I got a phone call. I was just going to leave the next day and go to Tacoma. And I received a phone call from one of those familiar voices in church administration in Pasadena. They said, "Well, we've changed your assignment. We decided to transfer you." I said, "I haven't even started yet." They said, "Well, we're going to transfer you anyway. So we want you to go down to Salem and see Mr. David Mills." And so when I called my wife, I said, "Well, we're not going to go where we thought we were going to go. We're going to go somewhere else." She said, "Well, I'm glad they told us before we got in the car and started on the way." So, because I just missed it, I made it by a few hours. But I talked to one of my neighbors there in the church, Van Dam Richard, who had lived in the area for a while, lived down in Oregon. I said, "Hey, they're going to move me down to Salem and Albany." I said, "You used to live in that area. What do you think?" He said, "You are the luckiest guy on the face of the earth." He said, "You will love those people. You will love that area there." He said, "I wish I could move back there myself." And you know what? He was right. We really did love every minute here. And Salem and Albany really were churches that we left physically, but I really never left. It's always like coming back home. I mean, I have to admit, Lois Baumann has not changed. She still looks exactly the same. Pam Penrod still looks 32 years old. John Penrod still acts 16 years old. I'm going to tell you something about John. Where is John? There he is. You know, they say it's really dangerous to be an amateur psychologist. So I have tried to stay away from amateur psychology, but I'll give you some of my amateur psychology experience. Back in the 1980s and 90s, the psychologists came out with this theory that we all have this inner child that's nagging at us, that's wanting to take us back to our childhood and deal with all these issues, whatever they may have been. And so we have to sort of deal with this inner child and all those things before we can be an adult. But I think John has always struck me as being the opposite. He's a child that has an inner adult that wants to come out, but really never has had the chance. Because it's just so much fun being what he is, so he just simply wants to stay that way. And I think that's wonderful, and certainly we could say that about a number of others. But it's always wonderful to come home, and it's a real blessing to be just a few miles to the north in Portland, another wonderful area. And as I've said many times, it's just great to have stayed in the Northwest, and certainly hopefully this will be our last assignment, and we'll be able to join the throngs of retired pastors in the Northwest. This seems to be the most popular place, other than, I believe, is it Dallas? There's another place where they seem to all be going to. Maybe it's some other town that they said a lot of them are going to. But at any rate, we want to thank everyone for the wonderful experience. And Wes and Terry Miller are down here. Can you raise your hand? I told a story in church yesterday in Portland about Bozo, that I owned this steer that was mentally ill, had a fried brain and did all kinds of crazy things. And some people didn't believe me, that he tore down your fence, went to the neighbors, and that we had 25 kids out running around a pasture trying to lasso him with Bill Rand. So if you don't believe the story, here's people who can verify that. In fact, they probably tell you a lot worse about Bozo. I remember the day when Wes called me up and said, "I called the butcher, Bozo's dying tomorrow." And I said, "Well, I thought we were going to let him go a few more months." "No, no, he's ready to go. He's ready to eat right now." So Wes had had enough with Bozo the clown, or Bozo the steer. But it was a lot of fun. Some of you are familiar with Homer's Odyssey, one of the famous pieces of classical literature. In Book 12, you may remember the scene. Odysseus and his men had left the island where they had stayed for several months rebuilding their boat. And Odysseus had received a prophecy from what they call the Circe that warned him of several things he would encounter on the next leg of his trip. The first warning Odysseus received was to keep clear of the sirens. The sirens lived on this hillside of an island with craggy rocks and outcroppings and headlands all around them. It was a very dangerous place for ships, and so ships were supposed to be sailing way out around them. But the sirens were voices. Homer records, "They sit and sing most beautifully as in a field of flowers. And the sounds, I might hear them myself so long as no one else did. Therefore, take me," he said, "and bind me to a crosspiece." So he had been warned about the sirens, that they would seduce him and that all the ship's sailors would want to go in to these voices that were saying, "Come, come to us. We will give you all these things." And they were women's voices and they sounded like singing. And so Odysseus was warned, stay away from them, resist the temptation, but the temptation cannot be resisted. So he did two things. Odysseus found some beeswax on his boat, and he kneaded it between his hands and got it all nice and warm and soft. And he put a large plug in the hearing and the ears of each one of his men. He says, "I'd hardly finished telling everything to the men before we reached the island of the Sirens. For the wind had been favorable, and all of a sudden it fell dead calm, and there was not a breath of wind nor a ripple upon the water. So the men furled the sails and stowed them, and taking to their oars, they began to row. Meanwhile, I took a large wheel of wax and cut it up with my sword, and I kneaded the wax in my strong hands till it became soft, of which soon did it between the kneading and the rays of the sun. I stopped the ears of all my men." So he had a wad of wax that he put in the ears of all of his men who were rowing. But Odysseus wanted to hear the seductive sound of the sirens, But he knew that if he did, he had been warned, he would then tell the sailors, "Go to the islands, let's see what they are," and his ship would be wrecked, and he would be lost, as would all of his men. But his desire was to hear the sound, but not to be seduced by it. So it says he ordered his men to tie him with ropes to the mast. And they tied his hands together and his feet together, and they tied his hands behind him on the mast, and they put ropes all the way around him. And he ordered the men, "When I yell at you to undo me and to sail over to the sound of the sirens, don't do it. Disobey my voice." He says, "When I got within earshot of the land, the ship was going at a good rate, and the sirens saw that we were getting inshore, and they began with their singing. 'Come here,' they sang, 'renowned Ulysses, honor to the Achaean name, and listen to our voices. No one ever sailed past us without staying on to hear the enchanting sweetness of our song. And he who listens will go on his way not only charmed but wiser. For we know all the ills the gods laid upon the Argonauts and the Trojans before Troy, and can tell you everything that is going to happen in the entire world.' They sang these songs most musically, and as I longed to hear them, further I made by frowning to my men that they should set me free. But they quickened their stroke, and Eurycles and Perimedes bound me with still stronger bonds until we got out of the hearing of the sirens' voices. Then my men took the wax from their ears, and they unbound me." That scene in the Odyssey was well done in the movie by that title, and it has been posted on YouTube. If you want to watch that scene, you can simply Google Odysseus and Sirens, S-I-R-E-N-S, and there'll be a number of clips come up that you can watch it. But this sirens event eventually became a byword and a buzzword in human behavior. Today, the term Ulysses' contract or Odysseus' contract refers to men who somehow make it impossible for themselves to fall into temptation when they know they are going to. In the psychiatric context, a Ulysses contract is a legal agreement designed to override a request from an allegedly competent patient in favor of a past request made by that patient. An example of when Ulysses contracts are invoked is when people with schizophrenia stop taking their medication at perceived recession times. So we have this event in history, and it's kind of an interesting thing because Homer and Shakespeare both understood human nature, and they wrote stories to teach their descendants and the entire world what they knew of human nature. Odysseus knew of his weakness, that if he would hear these sirens and their song they were making and these women's voices and the melodious music, it's actually fairly well done on the movie, that he would perhaps, almost without question, he would be seduced by them. And as the movie shows, as they are floating along this water and he's listening to these voices, through the water he can see the bones of sailors who had been shipwrecked and died there. So he ropes himself to a mast because he wanted to hear their message, but not give in. You know, human nature is a funny thing. The attractiveness of evil is never gone. The seductive sounds and invitations that we call temptation, certainly it is, it's like it never quits droning on and on. Everywhere you turn, we seem to hear the songs of the sirens of our time. As Christians, we must do all we can to keep ourselves unspotted from the world. And the history of this day, the day of Pentecost, teaches us a great deal about human nature. And perhaps this is a little bit of a stretch, but we also need our own set of ropes to make sure we are tied to the mast on our spiritual journey and we don't allow ourselves to be seduced and taken away. What I want to talk about today is that he who is in us is greater than he who is in the world. We face a tremendous battle. The forces of evil are on the march. I'm sure most of you have heard about the terrorist attack this morning in Orlando, Florida, where a bar, I guess it was a nightclub, was attacked by an individual who said he was loyal to ISIS. And about 54 people, I believe, was the last death toll that I heard. It seems those things happen more and more frequently than not on holy days or on days when God's people are assembled and worshiping him. And the demonic world is frustrated and angry, and certain things occur. In addition to that, we've seen more violence already in this political election than I think any political election, at least in my knowledge. If you see signs around Vancouver that say Trump or Donald Trump, most of them have graffiti spray painting on them with sort of bad names or whatever they want to write on there about them. There have been, as you know, riots and various people assaulted around the country, and it hasn't really started yet. The campaign doesn't start till after the conventions are over in the summertime. But there are certainly evil forces around the world that are being unleashed. Thankfully, on this day, we can look back at a very unique and fabulous, unparalleled event in history. In fact, this day, the day of Pentecost, on this day occurred two unique, fabulous, and unparalleled events in history that never happened before, no precedent, and never happened again. The first one, almost 3,500 years ago, was the coming of the great eternal God in power to the mountain of Sinai to give his laws to a nation after he miraculously delivered them from slavery in Egypt and brought them across the desert for about 2.5 months to the location there in Sinai. Moses gives us his final thoughts, his final lessons to Israel in the book of Deuteronomy. I want to begin by turning over to Deuteronomy chapter 5. A few years ago, I decided to do a study on all the last words of dying men in the Bible. Some are pretty obvious. The last words of David recorded for us, 2 Samuel, "He that rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. He shall be like the light of the morning as the day breaks, and the spring, as the grass springs forth in the springtime," or actually when the sun comes up with clear shining. The last words of Peter, 2 Peter, he says, "This tent is now about ready to be put away. I'm ready to put off this tent." So Peter's about to die. 2 Timothy, Paul says, "My time has come. My crown awaits me. My race is finished." There are other places where people give kind of their last testament or their last message before they die to those who were their students or who were their going to be their replacements. But the book of Deuteronomy is almost entirely in that category. Written in the last month of Moses' life, he rehearses what went on during his journeys with the people of Israel, and he kind of has some deep thought and some analysis, maybe some reflection on some of those things. But it certainly represents the last words of a man who knew he was approaching his death, even though he was physically as strong as he was at age 40. But he's reflecting back in a mere 34 chapters on what happened to Israel, their beginning, and he ends with a panoramic discussion of the entire rest of their history until the return of Jesus Christ. Let's begin in Deuteronomy chapter 5. This is, of course, going back, Moses is reflecting on the giving of the Ten Commandments on that day of Pentecost many years earlier, about 39, 40 years earlier. I guess it would be 39. Chapter 5 and verse 1, Moses called all Israel and said to them, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and judgments which I speak in your hearing today, that you may learn them and be careful to observe them." So he's rehearsing the Ten Commandments that were given, and he gives them, "The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb." Notice verse 3, and this is one of those verses that you have to stop and think about. You can't just read right over it. "The Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers, but with us, those who are here today, all of us who are alive." Now, those who were over 20 years old during that covenant that was made almost 40 years earlier were all dead. They all died in the wilderness because of their disobedience and their rejection of God. They didn't believe him. Only those who were under 20 survived. So these would have all been people basically 39 years and under, as far as their, or 59 years and under, as far as their age goes. And Moses says, this covenant was made with us, not our fathers. Some commentaries believe that the word fathers here means Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but doesn't say the fathers. He's saying our fathers, which most understand as meaning, this covenant was made with your parents, but really it is now incumbent upon you that you have inherited the promise they made, because they told God several times, "All that you have said, God, we will do." And then they very quickly went back on their word. So he said, this covenant is made with you, you who are here and alive today. And then he went in verse 4 and says, "The Lord talked with you face to face on the mountain from the midst of fire." You recall the account back in Exodus where the glory of God came down shining, the mountain rumbled like an earthquake, there was fire, there was smoke, the trumpet began to blast and then got louder and louder, and finally the people said, "We can't abide the presence of God, we're going to die." And so God began to recite the Ten Commandments, but when he was done with the Tenth Commandment, the people said, "We can't do this anymore. Moses, you go and you stand before us before God, but if we hear his voice anymore, we will die." So the people of Israel only heard the Ten Commandments, and Moses went up on the mountain and received the rest of the covenant, which they then agreed to when he came back down. But notice verse 4, "The Lord talked with you face to face on the mountain from the midst of the fire." And if you go through the details of Exodus 20, it just says they saw the words of God coming out of the mountain as if they could see the words actually moving in the air. They saw the finger of God in the form of lightning and fire coming out. And, of course, they were very, very terrified. Verse 5, "I stood between the Lord and you at that time to declare to you the word of the Lord, for you were afraid because of the fire, and you did not go up to the mountain." So he said, eventually, he said, after the Ten Commandments, I had to stand between you and God because you were so afraid. Verse 22, let's drop down there. We have a rehearsal of the Ten Commandments here. Most of us, I think, have those pretty much memorized. But after giving the final covenant, or the final commandment, verse 21, commandment number 10, "You shall not covet anything that belongs to your wife or your neighbor's wife or anything that belongs to him, servants, oxen, donkeys, or possessions." Then these words the Lord spoke to all your assembly in the mountain from the midst of the fire, the cloud and the thick darkness, with a loud voice. And he added no more. In other words, the people of Israel did not hear any more of his words. Moses had to go up the mountain and be the mediator of the rest of the covenant for them, because they were afraid at that time to hear him speak anymore. It says, "He wrote them on two tablets of stone and gave them to me." And so it was when you heard the voice from the midst of the darkness while the mountain was burning with fire that you came near to me, all the heads of your tribes and your elders, and you said, "Surely the Lord our God has shown us his glory and his greatness, and we have heard his voice from the midst of the fire, and we have seen this day that God speaks with man, and yet man still lives." He said, now, therefore, why should we die? We are afraid if this goes on that we'll all die. We're so afraid. And it's just such a power, we can't comprehend it. For this great fire will consume us. If we hear the voice of our God any more, then we shall die. For who is there of all flesh who has heard the voice of the living God speaking from the midst of the fire as we have and then lived? So they say, Moses, you go near and you hear all that the Lord our God may say and tell us all that the Lord our God tells you to do, and we will do it all. So they promised a number of times throughout the account in Exodus and also here given again. All that the Lord has said, we will do. Notice God heard their promise. The Lord heard the voice of your words when you spoke to me, and the Lord said to me, I have heard the voice of the words of this people which they have spoken to you. They are right in all that they have spoken. He said, I agree with their covenant. They are right to promise that they will obey me. But notice what he says in verse 29. Oh, that they had such a heart in them, that they would fear me and always keep all my commandments, that it might be well with them and their children forever. His great desire was that those people would have the heart to obey him, but he knew they could not. He knew that obeying him was the key to a good life, a life without regrets and without guilt. The language of the original here in verse 29 is very emphatic and very dynamic. It isn't just, oh, that they had such a heart in them. It's a groaning, it's a intense emotional, oh, I just so strongly desire. And my greatest desire is, my urgent feeling is that they would have such a heart in them and they would obey me always. Israel promised to obey God many times, but good intentions with poor character turns out to be a poor combination, because not very long, they began, of course, to disobey. And we all have record of that. So we have the command, seven more of the commandments and the statutes given and the promises. But let's go over to chapter 10. In chapter 10, Moses begins to rehearse the time when they were rebelling against God. And he came down the mountain. And, of course, here he had this golden calf that had been made. And he recalls just how terrible of an incident that was. So here in chapter 10, mentions here, at that time the Lord said to me, hew for yourselves two tablets of stone like the first, and come up to me on the mountain and make for yourself an ark of wood. And I will write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets which you broke, and you shall put them in the ark. So God says, come back up to the mountain. We'll replace the tablets of stone that were written by the finger of God. Make an ark also with two tablets, and I will put the tablets in the ark for protection. And so he says, I went up the mountain having two tablets in my hand. Verse 4, and he wrote on the tablets, according to the first writing, the Ten Commandments, which the Lord had spoken to you in the mountain from the midst of the fire in the day of the assembly, and God gave them to me. Now the account says that he wrote with the finger of God. If you have seen in the movie The Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston, that's probably getting sort of old and archaic now, but that may have been sort of an accurate rendition. Moses is up there and this flame of fire comes out from where God is there. Moses is kind of off on the side, but it actually looks like a fiery hand that writes on this tablet of stone. That may have been an accurate rendition. Some other things in that movie obviously were not, although much of it was based on their understanding of the Bible as best they understood it. But on the day of Pentecost in 31 A.D., another fiery finger of God appeared on the heads of the apostles. And it was the Spirit. The word finger also can be translated as spirit in the Hebrew and also into the Greek. So we have this Spirit of God or this finger of God that wrote the Ten Commandments on stone, but now has appeared to write those commandments in our heart and to make the keeping of those commandments fulfill this urgent desire that God had, which was that they would have a heart in them to actually keep them. So the writing of the Ten Commandments with the finger of God on stone and the writing of his laws on our hearts and minds both occurred on this day, although the account here in chapter 10 as actually later probably on the Day of Atonement. But that's a different time for a different study. But the first time it was, of course, on the Day of Pentecost. Okay, verse 5. I turned and came down from the mountain and put the tablets in the ark which I had made, and there they are, just as the Lord commanded me. It was probably a small box to contain the two tablets, and then they were both put in the Ark of the Covenant when it was constructed. Verse 8, at that time the Lord separated the tribe of Levi to bear the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and to stand before and to minister unto him. But verse 10 is interesting. As at the first time, I stayed in the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. So this would be the third time that Moses fasted for 40 days and 40 nights. I'm not sure any of us could fast for 40 days one time, much less three times in 1 4-month period as Moses did. He mentions, let's start down now a little farther to verse 12. Now, O Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command you today for your good. So that was that. Moses is simply saying this is what God requires, that he wants people to simply obey him, to serve him with all their heart, all of their soul, which Jesus Christ later said was the first and the greatest commandment. To keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, the lesser, more specific laws, such as tithing, holy days, a number of others, which I command you today for your good. Indeed, heaven and the highest heavens belong to the earth, or to the Lord your God, also the earth and all that is in it. God says, I own everything. I'm able to give you everything that makes you happy. But first, I command you to obey me with all of your heart. Verse 15, the Lord delighted only in your fathers to love them, and he chose their descendants after them, you above all peoples, as it is this day. And this is the first time this is mentioned. Therefore, circumcise the foreskin of your heart and be stiff-necked no longer. So learn to be pliable. Learn to be teachable. Learn not to be stubborn. Learn to have a heart that is pliable and that is receptive and that is not rebellious. For the Lord your God is the God of gods and the Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality and doesn't take a bribe. So God is a matter, serving God is a matter of justice, a matter of the heart. And he knew that human nature, being what it is stubborn, is stiff-necked, is rebellious against God. And that human nature or human effort alone, it simply is not possible to obey God. Chapter 11 and verse 1. Therefore you shall love the Lord your God and keep his charge, his statutes, his judgments, and his commandments. The exact same four things that Abraham is recorded as having kept in chapter 26 and verse 5 of the book of Genesis. Know today that I do not speak with your children, whom you have not known, who have not seen the chastening of the Lord your God, his greatness and his mighty hand and his outstretched arms. In other words, he's telling them, Moses is telling the people of Israel, this covenant belongs to you. It is passed on to you from your parents. It may be what Peter was referring to in Acts chapter 2 when he told all the people assembled there that this promise is to you and to your children and to as many as the Lord our God shall call. Because the covenants of God are forever and they continue forever and they are renewed to each new generation. Down in verse 16, Let's begin in verse 13 of Deuteronomy 11. It shall be that if you earnestly obey my commandments, which I command you today, to love the Lord your God and serve him with all your heart, with all your soul, then I will give you the rain for your land in its season, the early rain and the latter rain, that you may gather in your grain and new wine and oil. And I will send grass in your fields for your livestock, that you may eat and be filled. But take heed to yourselves. Now, just as a side note here, I'll be like the Apostle Paul. I'll stop in the middle of the sentence and divert off into a different subject that we've touched on. He never promised them eternal life. In all of these promises of obedience in the first covenant, he promised them physical things, peace, health, essentially long life, none of the diseases of the Egyptians, rain in due season, plenty of grain, wine, oil, grass for their fields. He did not promise them eternal life. That's why one of these seven changes in the new covenant was that it is founded on better promises. If you had the choice between the promise of good grass and good wine or eternal life, which one would you take? Not too hard to figure out, is it? So the better promises are one of the seven changes between the old and new covenant. And you can see these promises here were good. No one in that time especially would not want to have these first promises, but they were temporal. They were not eternal. And God only gave them to them, knowing that they did not have a heart to obey him forever. And so he could take away those promises and punish them. Whereas if we have the heart to obey God and we continue with it, he does not want to take away the promise of eternal life. In fact, in Hebrews 10 and other places where it mentions, it sort of indicates, you know, God obviously does not want that to happen, no matter if he can possibly prevent it. Jesus Christ said, of all those you gave me, I have kept them all. Only one is lost, the son of perdition. It's not God the Father or Jesus Christ's will that any be lost. But these promises he could take away from them and punish them and yet not lose them as a nation. Let's continue. Verse 16. Take heed to yourselves, lest your heart be deceived, and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them. The most awful or most difficult challenge in life for many humans is to be physically blessed too much. When we have too many of every physical thing we need, the tendency of man is to forget God. That's certainly the history of Israel. They only turned to God when they were hurting, when they were running from their enemies, when they were being punished. And the sad history of Judges and of much of the kings tells us that. So God says, take heed to yourselves, lest your heart be deceived, lest the Lord's anger be aroused against you. And he shut up the heavens so there be no rain, and the land yield no produce, and you perish quickly from the good land which the Lord your God is giving you. And so here we have a wonderful rehearsal of what was promised there and what God said they should do. And again, he mentions to them, verse 19, about teaching their children. Verse 22, about carefully keeping all the commandments which God gave him. And he says in verse 25, if they did that, no one would be able to stand against them. He would give them military victory and give them peace in their land. Let's go over now to chapter 29. We'll skip over to the latter part of the book. I find these last five chapters of Deuteronomy to be incredibly interesting. I never cease to enjoy reading over them and try to analyze what Moses was thinking and what God was inspiring him to do. In Deuteronomy chapter 29, Moses began to understand that only God could give the people of Israel the capacity to obey, to understand, to see, and to hear what he was trying to say. That in these years of Moses leading the people out of Israel and out of Egypt, and then going through the desert and the wilderness for those 40 years, Moses came to understand, before the people of Israel did, that their only way for salvation, the only chance they had to really obey God, is if God gave them the capacity to obey him. Chapter 29 and verse 1. These are the words of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab, besides the covenant which he made with them in Horeb. Now Moses called all Israel and said to them, you have seen all that the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his servants and to all his land. He said, the great trials which your eyes have seen, the signs and those great wonders. He says, yet the Lord has not given you a heart to perceive and eyes to see and ears to hear to this very day. I believe that Jesus Christ was referring to this when he mentioned that people did not have eyes to see or ears to hear. And he said, blessed are your ears because they hear and your eyes because they see. You've received this blessing that was withheld from the people of Israel. And Moses here is beginning to understand. Maybe he understood it years before, but the first time he writes it down and we have record of it is here in this chapter. He says, the Lord has not given you the heart you need, or the eyes or the ears that you need to understand, even to this very day. So he says in verse 5, I have led you these 40 years in the wilderness. Your clothes haven't worn out. Your sandals have not worn out on your feet. You have not eaten bread, nor have you drunk wine or similar drink. They have lived on manna. That you know that I am the Lord your God. So when you came to this place, you mentioned Sihon, king of Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan. He gave them victory so they would know that God was a God who would give them victories over all their enemies and would help them take the land they would need. And they simply did not abide. For some reason, those words superficially reached them. Verse 21 says, the Lord would separate him, all the tribes of Israel, for adversity, according to all the curses of the covenant that are written in this book, a warning about their disobedience. But then in verse 29, he kind of summarizes, Moses does, what God has said to him, what he's come to understand. The secret things belong to the Lord our God. In other words, maybe he's saying what he said back in verse 4, that God hasn't given you the eyes or the ears to hear and to understand and to see, or the strength of heart, a different heart to obey. The secret things belong to the Lord our God, but those things which are revealed belong to us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. In a way, he's sort of saying it takes a certain miracle from God for you to really understand and to have that secret. You know, there's that book about the secret going around, and I guess it's been a few years ago, and Oprah did something on it, and read a few write-ups on it. It seemed pretty bizarre. It's another form of New Age religion. But the real secret is that it takes God's Spirit. It takes God giving you a great blessing to be able to see, to have ears to hear and eyes to see, so as it says here, that we may do all the words of this law. Let's go to chapter 31. This is a strange assignment. At the end of Moses' life, God tells him to write a song and teach it to the people of Israel. Now, we don't have any earlier record that I know of Moses being a songwriter. He may have written some. You know that Miriam and the ladies sang and danced when they came out of Egypt on the last day of unleavened bread. But this is the first account we have of Moses being a songwriter. Chapter 31, let's begin in verse 14. The Lord said to Moses, behold, the days approach when you must die. Now, how many of us would like to hear those words? Well, we may hear them from our doctor if he tells us we have a diagnosable condition or death-ish condition, whatever. But essentially what he's saying is God says your work on the earth is done, and you will simply wait in the grave until the resurrection. Call Joshua and present yourselves in the tabernacle of meeting, that I may inaugurate him. So Moses and Joshua went and presented themselves in the tabernacle of meeting. Now the Lord appeared at the tabernacle in a pillar of cloud, and the pillar of cloud stood above the door of the tabernacle. So they were in front of the door. Behind that door was the pillar of cloud. The Lord said to Moses, behold, you'll rest with your fathers, and this people will rise up and play the harlot with the gods of the foreigners of the land. So God is telling Moses ahead of time, these people are going to be idolaters. They will rise up. They will learn the idolatrous religions of the land. Where are they going to be among them? And they will forsake me and break my covenant, which I have made with them. Then my anger shall be aroused against them in that day, and I will forsake them. And I will hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured. And many evils and troubles shall befall them. So they will have to say in that day, have not these evils come upon us? Because our God is not among us. So they would have to come to a certain repentance, a certain acknowledgement that their sins separated them from God and caused this punishment. Verse 18, and I surely will hide my face in that day because of all the evil that they have done, that they have turned to other gods. Now therefore, write down this song for yourselves and teach it to the children of Israel. Put it in their mouths that this song may be a witness for me against the children of Israel. Now, we don't have the tune. We don't have any record of people getting together and singing around the campfire, got their guitars out or whatever it was, and they begin to sing this song of Moses. But we have the words of the song, and they are very intriguing. So verse 22, Moses wrote this song the same day. And he taught it to the children of Israel. And there's kind of a break in the account right here. He inaugurated Joshua, the son of Nun, and Moses completing writing the words of Deuteronomy. So the rest of this probably is pretty much written by Joshua. Verse 26, take this book of the law, put it inside the ark. Verse 27, he says, for I know your rebellion and you are stiff-necked. Today, yet while I'm alive with you, you've been rebellious against the Lord. How much more after my death? Notice verse 28, gather me all the elders of your tribes and your officers, that I may speak these words in their hearing and call heaven and earth to witness against them. So Moses says, gather everybody, all 2.5 million, 3 million people together, that I may know that you understand what's going to happen after I die. For I know that after my death you'll become utterly corrupt and turn aside from the way which I've commanded you, and evil will befall you in the latter days because you will do evil in the sight of the Lord. So chapter 31 is where God instructed Moses to write this song, and Moses gets everybody together. Verse 30 says, Moses spoke in the hearing of all the assembly of Israel the words of this song until they were ended. So chapter 32 for the first 43 verses gives us the song. And the song is not just a summary of the history of Israel to that point, but it covers the time of Joshua and the settling of the promised land. And the last part of this song of Moses concerns their latter days before the return of Jesus Christ to rule the earth. It truly is an amazing song. We don't have time to study every verse today, but I'll hit some of the highlights. Sometimes you might want to do an interesting Bible study, go through it verse by verse and find out kind of what verses happened that he's talking about in the past, how many happened in the written history of Israel, and how many are yet to be fulfilled. He says, give ear, O heavens, I will speak, and hear, O earth, the words of my mouth. Let my teaching drop as rain, and my speech distill as the dew. So you have to picture yourself around the campfire, you know, singing cowboy songs, and all of a sudden you start singing the song of Moses. For I proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribe greatness to our God. Verse 4, he is the rock, his work is perfect. All his ways are justice. He's a God of truth and without any injustice. Verse 7 says, remember the days of old, consider the years of many generations and how God has dealt with people ever since the beginning. Verse 8, when the Most High divided the inheritance to the nations and he separated the sons of Adam and set the boundaries of their peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. So even at the very beginning, God allotted land that was to belong later to the people of Israel. Verse 10, he found him in a desert land. Desert. Jacob was living out in the desert. Abraham was too, wasteland. And he sent him into the land of Egypt where they could grow and prosper and become a separate nation without foreign influence because they were in a separate area that the Egyptians were not using and didn't much have much contact with. Verse 13, he made him ride on the heights of the earth that he might eat the produce of the fields and draw honey from the rock. So God brought him into a very beautiful piece of land and blessed him physically with peace, with crops, with all of the bounty of the earth. Verse 15, but Jeshurun, which is another name for Israel, grew fat and kicked. He grew fat and you grew thick. You are obese. He forsook God who made him and scornfully esteemed the rock of his salvation. So this rock is mentioned several times, and it is the rock, not just a rock. Some of the history of the Stone of Scone is given pretty clearly in some of the research books on it. The Association of the Covenant People has an interesting book on that subject, and they go through almost every place in Exodus, Numbers, and other places where the rock is mentioned, showing where they believe it was carried on a sled by the people of Israel out of Egypt and all the way into the Promised Land. And that's what it refers to here when he's talking about it. But the New Testament says it represents something else also. So we'll look at that in just a minute. Notice they provoked him to jealousy, verse 16, with foreign gods, with abominations. They provoked him to anger. And of course, verse 18, the rock who begot you, you are unfaithful. You have forgotten the God who fathered you. That happened back then, and of course, it happens even in our time. Now, let's drop down towards the end of this beautiful song. Again, I wish we could sing it, but we don't. Let's look down in verse 40. Actually, verse 39 begins the account of the return of Jesus Christ and what will be happening to Israel during that time. I see that even I am he. There is no God besides me. I kill and make alive. I wound and I heal. There is none who can deliver from my hand. He's referring to when Christ returns and begins to punish the earth for what they've done to the people of Israel and to the spiritual people of God. For I raise my hand to heaven and say, as I live forever, if I wet my glittering sword, my hand takes hold on judgment. I will render vengeance to my enemies, repay those who hate me. I will make my arrows drunk with blood. My sword shall devour flesh with the blood of the slain and with the captives from the heads of the leaders of the enemy. Rejoice, O Gentiles, with his people. He will avenge the blood of his servants. Where else do we have references in the Bible that God says he will avenge the blood of his servants? Revelation 6, the fifth seal, where the souls under the altar say, how long, God, before you avenge our blood? He says, well, it won't be much longer. I'll give you a white robe now, symbolizing that you're waiting for the resurrection. But your brothers who should be slain as you will have to join you before I finally take vengeance on those who have been doing this down through the history of time. So he will avenge the blood of his servants and render vengeance to his adversaries. And he will provide atonement for his land and his people. A lot written in that verse. God's going to come back and take vengeance. He's going to avenge his servants. And then he's going to provide atonement or forgiveness, reconciliation, and a sacrifice of atonement for his land and his people. He's going to regather Israel and establish that nation once again at a time far off into the future. So this song is a panoramic historical account of what's going to happen to Israel. Much of it already occurred, some of it yet to occur. But let's go over to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. I mentioned that Moses several times just in that verse mentioned the rock, that they rejected the rock that brought them water, that brought them safety, that brought them out of the land of Egypt. And here Paul is referring kind of in the historical sense to what they did, because they certainly did not set a good example. Without the Spirit of God, they were unable to obey. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, let's begin in verse 1. Moreover, brethren, I don't want you to know, or don't want you to be unaware, that all our fathers were under the cloud. They were following the cloud that inside was God. The cloud was a cloud of pillar of fire, covered by a cloud during the daytime, so the fire, the brightness of it would not burn their eyes and kill them. At nighttime, it appeared like a pillar of fire because that shining went through the cloud and made it look like a pillar of fire, but it certainly glowed, much like a lamp behind a lampshade type thing. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. Moses led them, following the cloud into the sea. And they ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. They ate of manna. They drank of the water that came out of the rock more than once. And that spiritual rock that followed them was, as it says here, Christ, the one who became Jesus Christ. So the rock represented Christ. But notice in verse 5. With most of them, God was not well pleased. Now, that's sort of an understatement, because there were only three that he was pleased with: Moses, Joshua, and Caleb. So when you got 2.5 million and three, that's not most. That's kind of like almost entirely all of them, which is just a very small exception. So it says, their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples. Notice the example that we are supposed to learn from studying about the events of these 40 years of wandering and their final movement into the promised land. To the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they lusted. So the three sins listed here, the first one is simply lust. Don't lust after the things that they lusted after. Verse 7, don't become idolaters as some of them were. So idolatry, wanting these either false gods of some kind into our life, idolatry takes a lot of forms. We are warned not to do that by reading that account. And finally, says verse 8, let us not commit sexual adultery or immorality, as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. So immorality, which today is paraded as if it's normal, everybody's doing it. It's sort of pushed on our kids from the time they first get into kindergarten, it seems. And the school systems seem more intent on that all the time. And, of course, some of the bizarre results of that that we've seen with these bathrooms being open to everybody, and who knows how that's going to eventually cause a lot of damage and how it will work out, but certainly very, very troubling events that have taken place in our country even in the last couple of years. So sexual immorality says, let none of us even come close to it. And then the fourth thing he says, nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. And if you recall that account, the serpents came out. It was in Numbers 21, verses 4 to 7. And it's after they had gotten a military victory and should have been celebrating, they instead began to complain against Moses and murmur about how they didn't like it out there in the wilderness. So idolatry, immorality, and then also you have here lust and then murmuring are these sins that we are supposed to learn not to do by looking at their example. Now let's go back to Matthew chapter 23, because all during their history, this rock that followed them desired strongly that they would keep his laws. In fact, the emotion that was so beautifully given by God that, they had such a heart in them that they would obey me and it would go well with them, is said here in different words, but it's the same emotion, and indeed it's the same being, the same God. Matthew chapter 23 and verse 37 simply says, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets, and the stones who are sent to her, and the stones that are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under my wings, but you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. So he says strongly, I wished how often I wanted to gather you under my wings and take care of you. Jesus yearned for them to keep his laws, and he wept just to think about it. But, of course, they didn't. They were unwilling. They simply were not able because they didn't have God's Spirit to keep the commitment that he gave, or they gave. Now, Jesus Christ does not change. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. So he also yearns together today for us, that he wants to gather us together and have us obey him and have him take care of us as a mother hen takes care of her little chicks. But today he's made it possible. He's made it possible for us to have the strength of his Holy Spirit because he is at the right hand of God and giving this wonderful power to us. For 1,400 years, Israel proved that man is incapable of keeping God's laws without help, without strong assistance. Now, the assistance that God promises us is not a rope that ties us to a mast so that as we intentionally place ourselves in temptation, somehow we are incapable of falling for it. Now, that's sort of a bad example, and I think there's kind of a double-edged meaning there to the account that we find in the Odyssey. But history proves that all mankind, as humans, are not as strong as the devil and the forces of evil. In fact, self-confidence is proven false, yet almost all religions teach it. They teach it by our own determination and by your own whatever good works. You can do that. You can simply obey and do what's right. Let's go to Matthew chapter 26. Mr. Reeves touched on this briefly, but I think it's good to read the actual account. These men had been with Jesus Christ for 3.5 years. And when he told them, I'm going to be arrested and you are all going to be scattered, they said, no. We are going to stay with you until the very end. And don't forget, several of them were carrying swords. Now, we think today, why were they carrying swords? Well, because they traveled and there were bad guys on the highways. And these guys were young and very athletic, fishermen. Back then, they didn't have big boats with power engines and big machines that pulled the nets up. They had to pull the nets up by hand. So these were very athletic, in good shape men, and they may have been very good at using their swords. So keep in mind that when they said this, they were, some of them, carrying weapons. So in Matthew 26 and verse 30, he says, they sang a hymn. They went out to the Mount of Olives, and we read this every year at Passover. And on the way out there, he said, all of you will be made to stumble because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you into Galilee. Then Peter answered and said, Even if all are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble. There's nothing wrong with being determined to obey God and be loyal, but if it's based on human effort alone, it is bound to fail. I just sort of wonder, perhaps we all do, looking back on the history of the church over 40 or 50 years, or I guess in Salem maybe going back 70 or 80 years, how many people have determined they were going to obey God, but were relying primarily on their own strength and not on the Spirit of God to give them the strength they needed? Perhaps maybe a reason why many have fallen by the wayside. We don't know. We can't judge. But just look at the scriptural examples. Perhaps that is still the case today. So Peter says, well, even if all these guys, if they stumble, if they're cowards, I'm not going to be. And Jesus said to him, Surely I say to you this night, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. So he prophesied to him, Oh, well, you're going to fall because you are relying on yourself now, not on my help. Peter said to him, Peter's arguing with, this is one of several times Peter argued with Jesus Christ, Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you. Notice, so said all the disciples. All the disciples said the same thing. They promised, no, we got our swords here, we're going to fight to the death. Notice down in verse 55, after he was being betrayed and arrested, Judas came, gave him the fateful kiss. The palace guards and the Romans who were there seized him. We know the details of the story. He said, Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to take me? I sat daily with you teaching in the temple, but you didn't seize me. All this was done that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled. Notice the next line. All the disciples forsook and left. And yet after they received God's Spirit, they became powerful men who withstood the Sanhedrin and withstood the great teachers of the law of their day, who were fearsome men, who were highly respected, who were the upper caste of that society. And they walked in there and said, You've killed Christ, and we ought to obey God rather than men. And tell us not to teach anymore. We're going to teach anyway. And so these men who were cowards in the spring, in March, a few months later, were now very courageous. And they were able to fulfill what they had committed earlier, which I will follow Jesus Christ unto the death. Let's go over to Colossians chapter 1 and verse 26, because the greatest mystery of all the ages, of all time, is that we need Jesus Christ living in us. Mr. Armstrong titled his book after these verses, because it's the great mystery of all humanity's experience. It isn't the answer of tying yourself to a rope, roping yourself to a mast. The answer really would be to simply stay away from temptation, to flee fornication, to avoid all the pitfalls and the temptations for lust and idolatry as much as we possibly can. Here in Colossians chapter 1 and verse 26 says, The mystery which has been hidden from the ages and from generations. It's a mystery that people can't see without ears given to them or eyes given to them by God, and can't hear without ears given to them by God. But now it has been revealed to his saints. To them God willed to make known what are the riches of the glory of this mystery among the Gentiles. He's saying twice, this is the great mystery of all the nations. Christ in you, the hope of glory. It isn't our own strength. It is not our own determination. It is determination combined with the strength of God. But that is the hope of glory. The hope of someday having a glorious eternal body. The hope of eternal life is based not on our own hard efforts, but on depending on the Spirit of God that's in us, that gives us the strength, Jesus Christ's strength, to come out of this world and to be obedient to the point of death. In fact, it says in Romans that the righteous requirements of the law would actually be fulfilled in us. Let's look over to Romans chapter 8 and verse 7. Paul is very clear about this when he's writing this book to the people in Rome. These two groups were competing with each other about who could be the worst or who could be the best. However, they were doing the comparing the Jews that they had the law, they had the history, they were a special called out nation, therefore they were better. They weren't as evil as the Gentiles. And the Gentiles said, no, we turned away from all these pagan ideas and now we have turned to the truth. And the Jews, after all, weren't keeping it right anyway. They're the ones who killed Jesus Christ. And, of course, it goes back a long way. But here we have in Romans chapter 8, he's telling them it doesn't matter what your background was. He spends chapters 3, 4, 5, and 6 telling them that all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And there is no hope for anyone except the same path we all must take, which is complete repentance and forgiveness. And then being rise to walk in newness of life after being baptized together with him in death. Romans chapter 8 and verse 7, because the carnal mind is enmity against God. This is a summary of the lesson of Israel. They were carnal. They simply could not keep their promise to obey God because they are not subject to the law of God, neither indeed could be. Verse 8, then those who are in the flesh, who are trying to obey God with their own power, cannot please God. I think Paul is very clear here in leading up to this chapter as to what he's talking about. When he says you are in the flesh, really what he means is you're trying to obey God and prove you're obeying God under your own power and not relying on the Spirit of God like you should. So those who are trying to obey God on their own power simply cannot please God. But you are not in the flesh. You are not trying to obey God just on your own power, but in the Spirit. You have the Spirit of God. Indeed, if the Spirit of God dwells in you. Now, if anyone does not have the Spirit of Christ, he is none of his. But if Christ is in you, your body is dead because the body is dead because of sin, but the Spirit of life because of righteousness. You're no longer living a life headed towards sin or involved in sin because you now have the Spirit of life in you leading to righteousness. In verse 11, if the Spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you, and that would obviously be the Spirit of God the Father, he who raised Christ from the dead will also give life to your mortal bodies through his Spirit who dwells in you. And so in these five verses, Paul is giving us a clear differentiation between what happens when a person does not have the Spirit of God and when one does. Those who lack the Spirit of God but are trying to obey God on their own simply cannot be subject to the law of God. Those who have the Spirit of God can be pleasing to God and can have the Spirit of God dwelling in them, leading to righteousness and eventually to eternal life. You know, the bottom line is really what I mentioned to begin with over in 1 John chapter 4 and verse 4. We have to understand this day the lesson that the apostles understood, the lesson that Moses came to understand, but he had no answer for, because there was no way made possible for the Spirit of God to be given to the people of Israel at that time. But he knew that without God being in them and giving them a different heart, that they would not be able to obey. But the opposite is very true. 1 John chapter 4 and verse 4, he says, you are of God, little children, and have overcome them. He's referring to these spirits that teach wrong things back in verses 1, 2, 3, and 4. Spirit of false teaching, spirit of the Antichrist. He said, you have overcome them because you've worked really hard at it. Is that what it says? Because you've tried really hard. You have good muscles. You have exercise. No. You've overcome them because he who is in you is greater than he who is in the world. So how do you think you're going to overcome sins and faults and weaknesses and challenges today? Is it by strapping yourself to a post and getting as close as you can to temptation? No, it's not. It's by understanding that you have a power dwelling in you, the Spirit of God the Father, and that power is greater than the evil influences in this world. It's greater than Satan the devil. It's greater than demons. You know what's interesting about Satan the devil? You do a study on him. What does the book of Job say Satan does? When God said to Job, when God said to Satan, so, Satan, what have you been doing? What did he say? Going to Burger King, having a hamburger and a Coke? No, he said, I've been going up and down on the face of the earth, just walking up and down on the face of the earth. First Peter 5:8 says, when he walks down in the face of the earth, he's a roaring lion seeking whom he can devour. So Satan is an opportunist. He's walking around trying to seek whom he can devour. And he's a pretty powerful being, and he's devoured a great deal of the world. But we can overcome him because he who is in us is greater than he who is in the world. And that is the only way we can overcome him. If we try it on our own and entirely on our own, we certainly are going to fail. I want to go over now to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. I think we'll be able to finish here today. Let's begin at verse 18. He says, you have not come to the mountain that may be touched, that burned with fire. He says, look, we all know the history of Israel. We all know the mountain burned with fire. It quaked. It had noise. It had the sound of a trumpet, and there was smoke, and there was fire, and the entire earthquake, and there were rocks flying, and we all understand that history. But we haven't come to that mountain with the sound of a trumpet and with the voice of words. We don't have this massive voice of angels out there. So that those who heard it begged that we should not be spoken to them anymore because they were afraid of the sound, for they could not endure which was commanded. And so if much as a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned or shot through with an arrow. And so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I am exceedingly afraid and trembling. Now keep in mind that at that mountain they made their promise to obey God and then very soon fail. So he's really reminding them, you made a promise too, to obey God. You made a commitment. But he says in verse 22, you have come to Mount Zion, that's the spiritual side of God, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels. So we have come to make our commitment to a spiritual Mount Sinai, or Mount Zion, not a physical one, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven. We have come to where the book of life has our name registered in it. To God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of just men made perfect. So we have come to a mountain to make our commitment, but our commitment is not made possible by our own physical efforts, but by the Spirit of God that's been given to us. So it says we've come to a mountain that has spirits of just men made perfect. And he just went through in Hebrews 11 a long list of those who will be in the first resurrection. And every year we bury more and more of our brethren who we know and have confidence will join this list of spirits of just men made perfect. And we'll see them again in the first resurrection. That we've come to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaks better things than that of Abel. So we have Jesus Christ and the Spirit of Jesus Christ living in us. Because on the first day of Pentecost, the law was given. But on the second day, a very powerful day, the finger of God came down and wrote that law and our hearts on our hearts and on our minds. And don't ever forget, as you think of that, that that Spirit is in you and that he that is in you is greater than he who is in the world.